The Prabhupada Ki Jai. The highest perfectional gain of humanity is to engage in discussions of the activities and glories of the pious actor. Such activities are so nicely arranged in writing by the great learned sages that the actual purpose of the ear is served just by being near them. It's always very strange for us. There's one criticism of education that sometimes education means sit still while I instill. This is the kind of feel our method is here. Sit still while I instill. But I have a suspicion that people are washing pots and, you know, vacuuming the house and everything else while we're talking. That's what I do sometimes. One other person, educator, is saying that normally the mind works, I think what it is, it's like 3 times faster than you can talk. And so like when you're taking notes or other things like that, you know, it's your audience, other visual things and everything else is a communication feature that unless someone like Prabhupada, then of course it gets very deep and very rich in the content. But a normal speaking level, the mind is going much faster. Okay, and if you can see the PowerPoint show here, I was wondering what little graphic to use to illustrate this. And I looked up RCA dog, and we got this famous picture. You know, supposedly it was very, you know, the history of this. It's a dog looking into an old gramophone machine, you know. And when I was a child, one of my friends, they were down the street, they were a Catholic family, David, Tommy, and I forget the other one, something. Yeah, and they had Michael, yeah. And they had one of the, it wasn't an old like gramophone machine, because this one you see in the picture here, it has a record and a needle which goes down into it, and the needle mechanically then shakes a little metal timbrene, which is amplified by the shape of the horn like that. But before that, they had the circular ones, they actually had cylinders that would slide on. And somewhere or other, they had a whole collection of these with all this music and so on. We'd listen to it sometimes, little kids, you know. So apparently when they were doing this, I think it was Pavarotti or something. He was a very, very famous opera singer, and he was singing. And he had this dog, like the little dog there, the same kind of the dog. And when they put on the thing to play it back, the dog ran over and was doing exactly this. He was like looking into the thing, you know, trying to figure out what was going on. Because here was his master's voice that was came up like that. So it's a very, very nice icon. He uses this for Krishna consciousness here. His master's voice. And even the dog, you know, can recognize, hey, this is the thing being reproduced here like that. So it's a very rich, rich image, I think, for putting Krishna consciousness in a real American sense. Yeah. So then the verse itself, of course, the perspective is that, you know, we're hearing the Bhagavatam again and again. The first 3 chapters is complete. Sutta has spoken to the sages. He's basically explained everything. But then they want more details, you know, okay, so on. So then he explains why Srimad Bhagavatam is the greatest of literature, why Vyasadeva did it after he did all the rest of the Puranas. Okay, then he tells the background about how he heard it from Sutta Goswami, sorry, from Sukadeva Goswami, you know, because Maharaj Pariksit was there. Why was he there? He was a motivated listener, right? You know, everybody in the class. Okay, I now curse everybody in this class. I won't do that. Okay, but what if I cursed everybody in the class to die? To die today, and you'll be hit by an auto accident, you'll have a heart attack or something else, you know. So then we become motivated listeners. 434, Bhagavad Gita, Tadviri Pranipatena, you know, very famous verse in the purport. Prabhupada says that blind faith and absurd inquiry are both condemned. So we should having. Well, but on Mohan does, he reverses all these things, you know. So absurd inquiry, the opposite is motivated listening. We've got a very good reason for listening. And, of course, one of the 4 elements in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 13, one of the elements of knowledge is janma, mritya, jara, vyadi. Approach a bona fide spiritual master, be humble, be tolerant. These are all elements we have to get knowledge. But why is birth, death, disease, and old age there? Well, let's say it's there because these are the real motivations, right? This motivates us. And unless we have that motivation, we haven't even begun our spiritual life. Spiritual life means immortality, right? And then freedom from distress. Okay. Then later on, we start getting the positive things and actually the different mellows of serving Krishna and seeing him smile and so on. So this motivation has to be there, motivated learning. So you want to hear it again and again from how did he explain it? How did he explain it? And how did different people explain this? And we begin to understand. That was something Prabhupada said. We heard from somebody. You know, I heard from Hansa Duda directly what Prabhupada said. Then I hear from Bhakti Srup Damodar Maharaj, who was in the same time there. Then I hear from Jayananda the same time there. And so now I'm beginning to pick up on, and it may not be wrong, because Prabhupada may have said, well, and so different people from different perspectives have picked up on what Prabhupada was saying with that well, you know, yeah, so on. So we begin to get what may be our perspective. And may, you know, we make several shiksha gurus in the spiritual world. Also, probably we're going to have a variety of shiksha gurus by which we connect ourselves to Krishna, you know, other things. So anyway, the perspective is they're hearing the Bhagavatam again, but now they're hearing how Maitreya spoke it to Vidura. And the person that's speaking is Suta Goswami, and how he heard it being explained to Maharaj Parikshit, who was a motivated listener. Okay. So in the beginning, he starts off explaining the creation. This is very natural for the common man, which I guess most of us are common men here. I don't know how many avatars we have in the audience. You know? But other than that, we're here. I mean, I'm looking out my window now, and I see the trucks packed, stopping at the cross street, you know, for in front of the Boys and Girls Club. I look across at the back of my, you know, my mall, which is kind of fallen down from its economic grace. Look at the backside of all my dumpsters, you know, and my yard. We're trying to mow the yard. I look at Buck Daniel, he's near me. You know, okay. And so we're trying to figure out this: how, where's God? Where's Krishna? You know, how do we see him always and do these different things? Because we do that, then no more Punar Janma. We hear about Krishna, then we can talk about him properly, and we can do it with intelligence, understanding, and then no more Punar Janma, Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smarnam. At that point, we can always contemplate Krishna. Yeah. We look at something, and it disappears or something, but if it's there for some time and it's nice, we can contemplate it. You know, a lot of times when I go to different programs at people's houses, they have big feast at night, you know, and I really say, let me make you a plate. Let me make you a plate, Maharaj. What's the first catastrophe? Because how do you know what I want? And the second catastrophe is if I try and make my own plate, and I'll never get up in the morning, you know. It takes about 6 hours to digest heavy feast. And even if you do take a heavy feast and you fall asleep, it's kind of like an intoxicated crash. And when you wake up, you're not, you know, you have to go take a nap again also. So while you're struggling with this of having a nap during the morning program, best time to work is from 2 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock in the morning. That's a Brahmin. And if you work hard during those hours, then after that, you know, the daytime is just play. It's like buying things, buying toys, you know. During the daytime, the ordinary person has to buy tools and has to go to work. But a Brahmin who works hard from 2 o'clock till 10 o'clock, He buys toys and plays. No tools and work, but toys and plays, and has a good time. Money's coming automatically. Administration's at the end of his finger. People respect his preaching. And all this stuff increases. And the evening time and enjoyment, okay. You know, as a Brahmin, you enjoy the Mahabharata, everything else, and so on. So, but your working hours are from 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock to 10 o'clock in the morning. Forming your intelligence, developing your perspective, you know, communicating, writing letters, everything ready, you know, so on like that. Okay, so with this perspective then on the creation, Brahma's going through, when he's first described Brahma, Maitreya, first he's describing Sarga in the first creation. And we're thinking about this in terms of also our own lives, you know, because Brahma is waking up, or something like that. You know, each day, this creation, to some degree, is going on there. So every day when we wake up also, the same things are happening. Our body is like a reflection, or an echo, better an echo of the cosmos. Our hands are symbolic representations of Indra. Our ears are, you know, being promoted by the Digvijayas, All over the world, there are hands. Everybody has hands. Cockroaches have hands. But Indra is a demigod that's his body. He's in charge of all these hands like that. Somebody else, Varuna, he's in charge of all the water. So our tongue is related directly to Varuna. Our ears are related to the Digvijayas. And we're connected to these things, and we begin to become conscious of them. Dhruva Maharaj, he stopped breathing, and because his body is connected to the whole thing, that starts to work backwards on the entire thing. If you in your house, for example, you have these intercom systems, you want to talk to one room to the other, they have these intercom systems you can plug in for many years, since the 1960s, I guess, or 50s, because your house is 60 cycles current, so it was like that. And so what you do is you plug one in your office, plug another in your guest bedroom, and no wires connected, but it connects to the electrical wires in the house. And all it's doing is modulating the 60 cycle current with an amplitude modulation. And so anybody on the same circuit in the house can decode it and pick it up, right? But now let's take a look at this. If we start shaking up the house current, that's going back to the line transformer on the telephone pole. Satsu tells a story as children. They did something. They blew out the landline transformer, and they hid in their house and never caught them. Yeah. So the line transformer is supplying maybe like six houses. But that you're connecting to that, and that goes back, and that goes to, to a power substation someplace, And the substation then goes back to the dam, like that. So by this process, you can see that Dhruva Maharaj was like holding his breath, but he then started to connect up with the breathing in the entire universe, like that and so on. So these bodies are, our bodies are symbolic representations of the universe. They're actually connected, and by doing different things with them. Of course, in our yoga, we do chanting and dancing. But these are very powerful things, singing and dancing. Always, and all over the world, there's always stories about different demons and goddesses and everything else being pleased by the singing and the dancing of their supplicants. So we do it properly. Krishna in the heart, Krishna the deity, is actually pleased like this. He actually is having fun with us. He'll come and join us in the kirtan. So this description of, is being described, the different demigods and their relationship with the different elements, like that. So when we wake up, are we fully awake? Are we going around like zombies every day? To what degree are we? Then what happens next? Okay, the different devatas are integrated with the different aspects, the elements, our bodies, and so on. But then they're not integrated as a unit. So then what happens is very interesting, because then all the different senses, the sense organs, they become integrated. And the Virat Rupa is formed like that, which is kind of like an imaginary conception, but on the other hand, it's also kind of real. It's kind of in between. Prabhupada says that the Virat Rupa is the, what's it called? The material incarnation of Krishna. Objective material incarnation. Of course, Krishna never becomes a material object, but it's the objective material incarnation of Krishna. So form is there. So our body, you put tilak on it. It's a respectable dude. It's actually a formation of these different elements. And somehow or other, the super soul in our heart, is he actually doing this work? Is he actually integrating everything in our body the same way he integrates everything in the universe? Because when we go through these things, analyzing, chanting, taking our chanting and our yoga to a deep level, then we begin to work through these things. In the beginning, maybe we're just chanting with our tongue, right? Then after that, we're chanting with our throat, and then we start to chant with an open throat, and it's coming from a deeper level. And we go through pranayama. We go through all these knots in our prana from previous anxieties, from previous attachments. We give them up. So now we're really chanting from a very deep level in the prana. And what's prana called in English? You say spirit, right? Spirit. Respiration, right? The Holy Spirit. So talking to one Catholic Christian priest for a long time, basically the Holy Spirit refers to prana. In many cultures, of course, we too, same thing too, refer to prana as life. You may think that, I'm coming to the spiritual platform, and now we're adjusting the prana in the body at a very deep level and stuff, and it's very nice. It's much more awake. We're not being motivated by things that we don't know. Jung, Freud, they all talk about this. Different knots in our prana from previous traumas are causing us to act in a certain way. And these are we're not conscious of these. But in our yoga, going backwards, we can start to see these attachments, and we can start to relieve them. Our posture may change. Instead of being stooped over and walking through life like a thief or frightened, we might start standing upright. Instead of being too upright and too arrogant, we may come down to a different posture, you know, body language. Yeah. So we adjust the prana at a deeper level. Then beyond the spirit is the psyche. And his priest was saying that both these things are used as soul in the Christian lexicon. But the psyche then is more like the subtle body. We're talking about mind, intelligence, like that. Until the 17th century, the word psyche was a formative for the soul. But after that, I think it was the 17th century, it came to mean the mind. And now in the 20th and 21st century, the word psychology refers to study of the brain. Psychology is the study of the brain and how the brain produces the mind and how the mind, I guess, you know, does something to produce whatever we're going to call the soul or whatever we're going to experience in that level. Yeah. So this first question is, we should look at the experience of this whole Virat thing is very relevant in terms of our yoga and seeing how these things are happening in our body and stuff and chanting. Yeah. And as we work our way through this, then we can come to the level where we're liberated, right? We come to Mahavishnu Loka. So the text here, finally, he's finished off his description of the Sarga and how Mahavishnu has created everything. And I guess the next chapters we'll get into Visarga. And Lord Brahma is created. And now Brahma is kind of like the prisoner. He's been in the prison bus. They let him loose. And he looks up. Okay, there's walls around the prison. I'm not getting out. You know, there's a big pile of cement and rebar, and there's the plans for living here and the rules and regulations and all that kind of stuff. So at one point, I think the planetary systems, who creates the planetary system? Who creates the kitchen? Who creates the bathing areas? Who creates the workshops? Who creates the recreation areas? Who creates the dormitory areas? Who creates the areas of different levels of punishment and castigation, depending upon, you know, where they are? So Brahma's involved with that to some degree. Garbhadakshay Vishnu is the prison warden, right there. Brahma's with him. What's it called? Bihabhagavatamrita. As you remember, that's where it is. It's describing it every day. You know, Vishnu, Brahma, with all the demigods behind him, they have darshan of Garbhadakshay Vishnu. And he's so beautiful, and there's an arati going on. Then the curtains close, and Brahma then turns to the demigods and says, okay, now, let's get to work. What's happening with Hiranyakasipu? What's happening here and there and stuff? So just like we have darshan at Mangalartik and the curtains close, we have darshan at the Noonartik and the curtains close. So same way, Brahma has direct darshan of Garbhadakshay Vishnu. And he knows, he's my lord. He's the guy that's controlling the universe. He's the heart of my universe. But along with that, who creates the different planetary systems? It's a question like that. And maybe different degrees. Maybe it's at that point, maybe Brahma's actually involved, but Vishnu is still working a lot. Okay, and then after that, Brahma then creates the Manus and all these like mental children, right? And the Manus then have sexual relations and start producing the prototype species of horses, cows, scorpions, and I think the semi-demigods, like Apsaras and Kanaras, you know? And then they, of course, come down somehow or other to Bhumandala in our levels and other planetary systems like that. So it's a very, very interesting creation story, you know. Okay, let's go ahead here. Telling all this and describing the glories of the Lord, which is quite extensive, it's way beyond the Bible and everything else to some degree, but it's not to the level of Goloka. We're still on slide number 4 there. Let's go back to the verse, yeah. So if we look at number 4, at the verse, let's look at it again there. Okay. The highest perfectional, so now he's describing what he said before, because he said, how can I describe all the glories of the Lord? Even the glories of Mahavishnu we can't describe unlimitedly. Or the Super Soul, how wonderful he is. You know, the Paramatma. So many people have experienced the Paramatma, being there with them and, you know, different things like that. And he's so interesting, so glorious, so merciful. So the highest perfectional gain of humanity is to engage in discussions of the activities and glories of the pious actor. So now we have a kind of a Upanishadic name for for God here, you know, the pious actor, you know. And again, he said, yesterday he said, I can't describe him completely, but unless I do this, my tongue will be unchaste. You know, it won't be telling the truth unless I engage it in describing God, you know. So he wants to discuss the activities of the Lord, so many pastimes. He helped Noah build the ark. He helped David do this and that. And the glories. So what does glories mean? We hear it about it all the time. What are the glories? Well, somebody has different qualities, different things, but some things can be infamous. And Al Capone, he did this bad thing, he did that bad thing. So the glories, of course, are the things that are great about somebody. You know, his beauty, his activities, like that. Okay, so that's the highest perfectional stage, is to always discuss these things. We may not come to a conclusion, but we may bring them in more and more refined perspective. You know, you may understand how they're developing each time. If Nara comes each time with Narayan, he incarnates, then probably they're discussing everything and what they did. And even Krishna and Balaram talk about, you know, being here. And, well, next time let's try and catch more conditioned souls by doing this. Oh, Balaram, you're way off. You know, yeah, we've got to keep the standard. You're always trying to stretch things and help them out. No, you're always trying to be too high and stuck up. Okay, so Krishna and Balaram are arguing about how to do the next incarnation to catch more fallen souls. Such activities are so nicely arranged in writing by the great learned sages. Okay, this is a very interesting point. Because is there a structure to the Vedas? Is there a structure to all these Krishna Kathas? Well, definitely we say, yeah, the Puranas. Definitely the Puranas are describing, you know, Tamasic Puranas, Rajarshik Puranas, Satvik Puranas. And so, yeah, they're designed for different people. The idea would be that if you actually follow a Tamasic Purana, it's going to elevate you to the mode of passion where you get up and want to get a pretty wife and have a nice car and, you know, have a place in society and have clean clothes every day, not picking out your least stinky, dirty shirt before you go to work like that. Okay, you know, change your drink, rethink your drink. Yeah, and finally, living in the mode of passion, that will bring you to the point of actually the mode of goodness, of introspective life, philosophical life, and considering immortality and things like that. And the Bhagavatam itself, here's the whole question, is it arranged as a progressive study? And so, of course, it definitely seems so. You know, the whole thing is actually 12 cantos, and they're supposed to take us to different incarnations, and we should be studying, you know, studying in a progressive fashion like that. Maybe some of us are at the third canto, some of us are at the seventh canto, but there's a development. We're only qualified to worship Krishna's lotus feet. We're still drinking beer, and, you know, I still haven't got our relations quite worked out with the opposite sex. Okay, but you're a devotee, so you can go ahead with the first two cantos. A little bit more advanced, okay, now you're starting to be a little bit more reliable in your service. You still, you know, now the master says, please take this ring and deliver it to my beloved, you know, otherwise she's going to die, and there'll be so many problems. So you take the ring and you kiss the master's hand and you say, yes, sir, you can count on me, you know. Okay, I won't be tempted by cigarettes and, you know, discount cigarette and cheap beer stores, yeah. So then a little higher than like Hanuman, when he came back, what happened? And Ram was so grateful. He said, I can't give you anything. I have nothing here to give you. All I have that I can call my own is my embrace. So he embraced Hanuman. That's quite a gift. The prophet takes you and embraces you and says, thank you. You've done something which I'll never forget. Well, okay. So when we go up to the chest, you know, Hanuman, he has Dasya Ras mixed with some Sakya Ras like this. So probably he's feeling very embarrassed or something that Ram is embracing him. Here I am, a monkey. I'm a monkey and Ram is embracing me, you know, so on. Okay. Then higher, of course, is Madhurya Ras, which is the one thing I read by Murari Gupta. He said the essence of Madhurya Ras is joking. You know, always kind of joking between the boys and the girls, the lovers. And so then we come into the smile and the face and all this kind of stuff, you know. So now we're talking about a different kind of, we've gone beyond the creation, which is all at the lotus feet of Krishna, and we're going up. But as we go up, we have to always keep improving our foundation. You know, a one-story building, you know, what kind of foundation does it have? But a 25-story building, okay. And they're talking about a 90-story building, okay. So our shantaras, our detachment from matter, you know, has to go on progressively increasing as we're going up like that. And if we're not going to get Madhurya Ras in this lifetime, oh boy, we've missed it. Maybe we'll have to wait again till Lord Chaitanya's Leela for another day of Brahma before we can get a chance to advance. You know, so Lord Chaitanya is offering the highest thing. He's offering Goloka. He's offering, what's it called, Shringar Rasa, Madhurya Rasa. And he's offering Madhurya Rasa in the mood of Radharani. He's offering Madhurya Rasa in the mood of Radharani in even a more advanced state. Here's a question. What's the more advanced state is he offering than Radha Bhava? Okay. Okay, so is it nicely arranged? And we should understand this. We should understand how our lessons are arranged and make sure we're taking the proper classes. Not that we're in the fifth form and we're walking into the kindergarten class. No. Or we're not above our level. Okay. The sages do this. So the purpose of the year is served by just being near them. And here's our doggy again. He may not understand what's being sung. Shrimbatam Swakata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtanaha. You just sit in the class. You sleep in the class. Even now. It's being near them. And the ears are purified. Our basic point is as much as you can engage in hearing and chanting, just do that. If you're engaging in hearing and chanting, automatically you should be thinking about something, talking about something, and doing something, right? You're cooking the feast with your hands, you're talking to other devotees about which preparations need to be done, and in your mind you're thinking about the feast, cooking, preparing it. So we should be living all simultaneously at three different levels. And even if we're, again, like a shudra, that's our tendency to become absorbed in our senses and our sense objects, you know, even still as a devotee, the soul is energized. And so the soul has been energizing the intellectual and the mental levels, and the verbal levels like that, in a spiritual perspective. You know, Jayananda, he was like, of course, a typical example of a shudra, always absorbed in building Rathyatra carts, building prasadam, you know, mobile kitchens, taking out the trash, everything else, you know. Hitting big kirtans, you know. But he was always talking about Krishna. We were building a mobile oven type. It was a small trailer, and he put two big burners on it and a side table so you could haul this place something someplace and actually cook prasad have that right there and stuff, you know. So we were welding it and putting it together, and the welder, it was Ricardo, Dr. Ricardo. We started talking. He and I started talking about something else. Then Jayananda said, "Wow, this is going to be really useful tomorrow at the festival." So we just started talking about the festival then. And I was thinking, did he do that consciously or what? Probably even subconsciously, not talking about Krishna was a little irritating to him on a subconscious level. And he just kind of like brought the katha right back to Krishna, just out of a desire to get out of the sunlight, you know, or have something to keep from being disturbed. But yeah, he was always thinking about Krishna and everything else, even though he was absorbed in his sense. The natural thing was to let most of his consciousness be absorbed in the external energy like that. Okay, so even being near these things, you know, is a wonderful benefit. Okay, next slide. Let me go ahead here. Prabhupada's purport. Okay. Prabhupada says, the impersonalists are very much afraid of hearing the activities of the Lord. Okay, so Prabhupada right away contrasting this whole verse with the other side of the thing. He's talking about Krishna Katha and liking to hear Krishna Katha. The impersonalists are very much afraid of hearing the activities of the Lord because they think that the happiness derived from transcendental situation of Brahman is the ultimate goal of life. They think that anyone's activities, even that of the personality of Godhead, is mundane. But the idea of happiness indicated in this verse is different because it relates to the activities of the Supreme Personality who has transcendental qualities. And, of course, this reminds us of the next verse. Let's go to, I think I have it in the next slide, number 6. Okay. Yeah, 1.7.10. Of course, this is the verse that Lord Chaitanya presents twice. Atmaramas chamunayo nirgranta piru krame Kurvanti Ahoy Tukim Bhaktim Itam Bhuto Guno Harahe. Let's all close our eyes now and do it from memory. Atmaramas Chamunayo Yirgranta Apiru Krame Kurvanti Ahoy Tukim Bhaktim Itam Bhuto Guno Harahe. All different varieties of Atmaramas, this is right in the first canto, especially those established in the path of self-realization, though freed from all kinds of material bondage, desire to render unalloyed devotional service under the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This means that the Lord possesses transcendental qualities, itam bhuta gunat harahe, and therefore can attract everyone, including liberated souls. So that's our hypothesis. Yes, become liberated. But even before you're completely liberated, you can start to be attracted by Krishna's qualities and activities. And that's why everybody wants to serve Krishna, because he's such a cool dude like that. If you meet, when we meet Krishna in ordinary life, we meet Prabhupada, we meet a devotee. Devotees are just so far out. They're just in their own ways like that. Even if they're doing something stupid, they know it and they laugh about it, and we tease each other. You know, other people are so flat and so boring in so many ways. Okay, so next verse, next slide here. Okay, I got it. The word gunavadam is significant because the qualities of the Lord and his activities and pastimes. There's a difference? Okay. His activities and pastimes are the subject matter for the discussions of the devotees. The word gunavadam is significant. Wait a second. I got that twice. Okay. Twice. Okay. Jiva Goswami therefore concludes that the topics regarding the transcendental activities of the Lord are far beyond the transcendental realization of kaivalya, happiness. So Prabhupada's producing these purports from the commentaries of Jiva Goswami, who else? Bhaktisiddhanta, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Vishwanath Chakravarti, Sanatana Goswami, like that. So when he's saying this, probably I would suspect that he's saying what Jiva Goswami says. He's summarizing it. And maybe Jiva Goswami has a lot of evidence then, you know, about Kaivalya, which is not so relevant for us because we're not on this level. Basically, we're trying to go from eating hamburgers and Coca-Cola up to, helping Radha and Krishna meet in Vrindavan. Our process is more sublime. Yep. These transcendental activities of the Lord are so arranged in writing by the great sages that simply by hearing of those narrations, one becomes perfectly self-realized, and the proper use of the ear and the tongue is also achieved. You know? So the Bhagavatam, taking it systematically, okay, next slide, and going ahead systematically from the lotus feet of Krishna up to his lotus lips. Srimad Bhagavatam is one of such great literatures, and the highest perfectional stage of life is attained simply by hearing and reciting its contents. So if you can do this full time, you invest your life, live for free, grow your own vegetables, and while you're growing your own vegetables, you're chanting Hare Krishna, other people in the field. You see different movies like, you know, people out there, the happy farmers, you know, harvesting the crops and singing together and that kind of stuff. But yeah, why not? Why not? Or you're discussing what the Brahmanas presented last night. Last night, the Brahmanas had a really great puppet show, and it's going on with the Mahabharata. And so people are talking all about it and what Bhishma did and what Arjuna did, and he thought this and that. And that's a common thing. Every morning and evening, the people, especially in the evening, people get together, and the Brahmanas would lead all this kind of Krishna Katha and dramas and presentations like that. And so your village entertainment was far beyond television, far more stimulating in most cases than television like that. Okay, slide number 9. I think it's the last one. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. All glory to the Prabhupada. And I was going to toss in one more thing here. I can do that. Okay. And this is the Bible. Genesis. I just clicked it up real quick. I didn't get a chance to look at it, but there's actually apparently a Wikipedia page. Somebody asked, I pay $50 a year for the Britannica. Okay. And somebody apparently asked the director of the Britannica, what do you think of the Wikipedia? Yeah. And he smiled and said, I use it, you know. You see, the Wikipedia is like a chisel, and the Britannica is like a drill, like a needle. He said Wikipedia is great for finding the general structure of thing, what people are talking about. But in the Britannica, he said, it's much more limited. And a lot of stuff which you'll find in Wikipedia as general things, which may not be so confirmable, doesn't make it into the Britannica. So the two good books are good. Then apparently somebody had the genius idea. They submitted Wikipedia articles on something and Britannica articles on something to like independent scholars. And the independent scholars, somebody like they liked the Britannica articles like 85% of the time as being correct in their field, and the Wikipedia articles like being 70%. So there wasn't that much difference in what they considered to be the authenticity, you know, so on. Anyways, you look up the Wikipedia article on creation, Genesis, might be good. And also then here I followed the link and I got the New International Version of the Bible. So it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and earth. Oh boy, we want to look at the original text Greek for that. Hilda Adamar yesterday was saying that this is all put in Greek when it was first written like that. So what, of course this goes back before that, this is Jewish. This goes back before the New Testament, yeah. So this can go back a long way. So what do they mean by the heavens and the earth? Is this Swarga and Bhumandala, or is it Vaikuntha and Bhumandala? Now the earth was formless and empty. Sounds like us. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. It sounds just like what? Garbhadaksha Vishnu entering into the universe and producing all the water. And God said, let there be light. Okay, so it sounds like he's creating the Agni Vesh demigods. And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. Okay, so before that there was no daytime here. And God said, let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the vault and separated the water under the vault from the water above it. Well, that's interesting. Okay. And it was so. God called the vault sky. So what's the word there? And there was evening and there was morning on the second day. Okay. So this is very nice. But of course, people are pointing out we still haven't got a sun here, fellow. So what do we call the day and the night? The light's coming and going. And so it doesn't necessarily mean a solar day. It means God's just kind of like turning it on and off or something. You know? Yeah. And also this is very similar. So where do these come from? Socrates says in the Phaedo, there is a very ancient doctrine which says, and so they're accepting that these stories are coming from more ancient sources. Archaeologically, where did the Jews get these from? I've seen archaeological descriptions that they themselves were not necessarily monotheists, but all over the Mediterranean was this thing of the South Mediterranean was the worship of all, as in Alhambra, Alcazar, you know, like that, you know, Alameda. So Al was the sun god, but not in a strictly pantheistic sense, more in a, what do you call it, like, you know, the supreme lord manifestation sense. So that's where they started to get their, develop their own monotheism. And where do they collect these stories from? Okay, so archaeologists, this is your passion. You can start to look back. If you find evidence that there was connection to India, and all over the world, there was communication of the same understanding of how the cosmos is created. Okay, the second day is finished. We got light and dark. We got the waters above. We got the oceans and the clouds. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let dry ground appear. And so it was. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas, and God saw it, and it was good. Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants, and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds, and it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it. In it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good, and there was evening, and there was morning on the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day and the night. Okay, so the universe is created in 7 days and seven nights, but hey, these weren't like our 7 days and nights at all. And then let them serve as the signs to mark sacred times and days and years. And let them be lights in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the great light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw it was good. And there was evening and there was morning on the fourth day. Okay. And God said, let the water teem forth with living creatures, let birds fly above the earth across the vault of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living thing with which the water teems and that moves about in it, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was a morning on the fifth day. And God said that the water land produce living creatures according to their kinds, the livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, the wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kind, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. This is at least a lot more interesting than we call atomic physicists and their creation model. This is incomprehensible. You got to study mathematics something like 20 years before you can understand the language you're using. And they criticize religion for using arcane language. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and every other living creature that move on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. This, of course, is a kind of nice basis for vegetarian discussion. But they'll say after this, of course, after the flood, it was different. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good, and it was an evening on the sixth day. Okay, so it's kind of time to stop here, and I guess then if you're really interested, you can see what God did on the seventh day, according to the Bible. But it's very nice, this comparison of and the creation in the Bible and our creation. And again, it's much more sane than the one the scientists are describing. Even if it's true, it's incomprehensible, and I would say impractical. It's going to generate all kinds of totally absurd ways of manipulating matter that is so impersonal and so distant from human beings like that, you know. Now we're all absorbed with lasers. We have lasers in our wristwatches, lasers in our media players, everything else, you know. And so we can't even hear other people. I was listening to one Christian preacher on the radio. She has a book out, and it's all about how to regulate your kids with their internet access. She said, don't let them have cell phones or tablets when they go to bed. You kind of go check them all at the door. She said one of the most dangerous times for kids like 11, 12, 13 years old is 11 o'clock at night until 1 o'clock in the morning, because they get into these gaming things, you know, adventure gaming things with kids from different continents and stuff. And in the room when they're alone at night, they'll be there gaming or doing pornography and stuff like that and so on. And then finally she suggested to every modern family, you take one day with no electronic devices, except for maybe the refrigerator and electric stove during the week and one day on the weekend, like that. And that the kids pick which day it is. So it says usually kids will pick something like Wednesday and Sunday because they're in church anyway most of the day on Sundays, so they won't lose it. So she said she was, in the book, she recalls the story, that in the church, one little kid came up, an 11-year-old kid, that came in and said, "Are you the lady?" And she said, "Well, what lady, you know? Are you the lady that told my daddy to restrict us from this stuff twice a week?" And she was thinking, "Oh, my God, this kid's going to, you know, hate me and yell at me for taking away all his stuff." Because kids get very addicted. That's her point. Or the kids, we get addicted, you know? And so she said, "Okay, I got to be brave." He said, "Yes, I said that. It's a good thing." And he told her, he said, "Yes, you're right. It's a very good thing." She said, "I got my daddy back." It's a very touching story, you know. And he said, "But before my daddy would come home, he would just start looking at the news. He would never talk to us. And now we go out and play ball. And we talk about stuff. And now my mommy and I make cookies and stuff, you know, those days. And I wanted to thank you." Yeah. So this, you know, electronic media, personal technology based upon a personal creation of the universe. And it works. Music, architecture, everything else that naturally follows from this model. And we have to adopt it. Okay, thank you all very much. Hare Krishna, any questions, comments, complaints?
Maharaj, when you were reading that nice Christian description of the universe, I like how you brought that up. It does. It is, I guess, next to ours. You know, it doesn't come to the mark of ours, but it makes a lot more sense than what the scientists say. I mean, it doesn't sound, in one sense, that far from the mark. My question was, you were talking about, I know everybody's listening very carefully at this point, you were talking about how the Lord created all the different species and that man would rule over them. And they were waiting to see what else you would say, you know, to support our vegetarian claim. But then you made a comment, and you just went right on past that. And you said something to the effect that, "But they'll say that all changed after the flood." What were you referring to? Hello?
Am I all right?
Hello, yeah. I had to unmute myself. Yeah.
Did you hear the question?
Yeah. Because you can find these Christian books and every different groups like that, and they're giving all these citations from the Bible that support the vegetarian diet and everything else like that and so on, you know. But then I saw like a more objective one, and I think it was even Stephen Knapp or something, you know, go on. And when it comes down to it, I think as far as I can see at this point, the objective thing is the Bible, you cannot really, you know, support strict vegetarianism from that stuff. There are like statements in this and that way and killing an animal. But of course, it's all a desert atmosphere, everything else. And also, like I think somebody was saying, it's coming down from such, you know, different strange sources. And P. Dayananda is saying, okay, well, the pretty much we have like scrolls and copies and stuff from a pretty modern age. And we're talking about all the way back, you know, the creation of this and Moses, you know, creating the Red Sea and all this kind of stuff. So at least from the scholarly point of view now, as far as I can tell, it's not really, you can't really support strict vegetarianism on the basis of the Bible. There's a lot of stuff in there, a lot of stuff you can use and that kind of stuff to talk about it. And, of course, the general principle of nonviolence and of peacefulness and so on. I think when it says go and conquer the earth, this is a subtle point of translation again, too. The word is dominion. But all these, you know, crown dominion means like, you know, Canada is crown dominion. And it means more like animal husbandry. Husband doesn't eat his wife, you know, like that. Exploiter. The idea is actually protect her and maybe give service to her rather than taking service from her. So there is like a subtle point in that, with God saying, you know, dominate the earth in the sense, it's been sense of being a servant, you know, servant leader to some degree. But then what happened is that they'll say, the comment is that all this stuff, yeah, was vegetarian or something and eating fruits and stuff, you know, until the flood. Then after the flood, then there's some comment that actually then it was allowed to eat meat and everything else and kill the animals or something like that and so on. So that's one, you know, apparently one in the Bible, there's support for that kind of thing happening.
Mm-hmm. Where is that support in the Bible? Or after the flood, it was okay.
Where this section talks about the flood, and after the flood, then it starts talking about, you know, what they're allowed to eat and that kind of stuff.
Hmm. Does it actually say? I mean, I've never read it. Does it actually say?
Okay. Yeah, I'm not like a real super scholar in this, but I've seen, like, you know, the arguments, and then the meat eating guys and whatever, the, you know, the neutral guys are coming up and they're giving citations and stuff like that. And yeah, it's not just like a speculation. There are statements and stuff that support that in their idea.
Okay. Any other
Harsh,
questions?
Harsh, did you want to ask this question, or do you have a mic? It's in the chat. Maharaj can't see it. I can read it. Shall I, or can you unmute yourself?
I can see chat here. I see Robert Sharon.
It's his stop.
Yeah, I'm online here. So far, it hasn't broken either. My faster computer and a faster cell phone, my hotspot's working mostly. You pay what you get what you pay for. More expensive computer, more expensive phone, I have better service. So. Okay.
You see where it says one question about hands?
Huh?
You see about where it says about Indra?
I'll go back here. Harsh. One question. If hands are a part of Indra, then why one hand of person behaves differently than the other hand? That's kind of a good question. And that's what we start. I mean, we're talking, right now we're doing, we're talking about, you know, science, you know, science one. Like you have your first in the high school, even before that, they teach you science. You know, now we have music, now we have civics, now we have geography, now we have history, boys and girls. In the sixth grade, now we have science. In science, they'll start teaching you about solid, liquid, gas, or something. They'll cut an onion, and I remember this: they cut an onion in our class, and everybody had to raise their hand when they smelled it, and you could see how the smell was being, you know, progressively passed on. Okay, so what we're doing in the Bhagavatam is the general principles of physical nature and how it works, and the hands are symbolic representations of Indra. Okay, but if we get into Gandharva Veda, then that's why I understand we're going to start going into the details. We're going to apply this. And so in Gandharva Veda, yeah, the left hand, the right hand are important. You know how maybe you would, for example, right away there's Ida and Pingala. In the spine, there's two different nerves. You know, one is ascending, one is descending or something. And one ear is Devahu, other ear is Pitrahu. So one ear is for things spiritual, higher. Other one is for the ancestors, for sense gratification. So therefore, we try to hear our japa through the right ear. The mantra is received from the spiritual master through the right ear. So right away, we start seeing different reactions. So if it's a normal person, then the right hand and the left hand have to do with two different functions and stuff and so on. And so how this specifically relates to Indra, I don't know. And maybe it just passes right through Indra. Indra has a right and a left hand, you know. So but that goes back to something else and why. Why is the right hand white magic and the left hand is black magic? Why do we eat our food with our right hand and, you know, take care of our cleanliness and our lower part of our body with our left hand? You know? So these are very good questions, and then other Vedic literature may explain it. You know, when you start getting into these things. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yep. Okay.
Anyone else have a comment or a question?
Maharaj, Ramananda and I were discussing before class, I guess before you came on board, about, I was just noting that we went to a different meter for our Sanskrit verse today, a longer, nice meter, and generally a different melody that we chant. I was wondering that, I was assuming, kind of philosophically speculating, because I've never read it or heard it, that these verses were composed by Srila Vyasadeva. This wasn't exactly what was spoken verbatim from, say, the lips of Suta Goswami and Sukadeva Goswami, etc. I would assume they probably spoke more in prose. I mean, this was just written poetically as as Srila Vyasadeva compiled the Bhagavatam. Does that sound right or wrong, or what are your thoughts?
Well, in the Brahma Samhita, it says every step is a dance, and every phrase is a song, and the sound of the flute is the dearmost friend. So at this level, I wouldn't be surprised that they were able to talk in poetry and to compose poetry as they go along. You meet intelligent people, especially like this Indian culture, and people who have born in good family, brahmachari from birth, stimulated by proper education, and they have extremely fine abilities and intelligence and stuff. And they sit there, compose, even in Chinese literature, I can get into that. You see, they would do this. They would have competitions of just generating poetry, and you couldn't pause. And somebody else would come back with a counter poetry. And they would play these mental games, which would make us look like morons.
Wow.
Literally, compared to this. This is even within history and stuff. And then what would be nice is one book, very nice book, it's a little Sanskrit grammar, which was done by a devotee from Vrindavan. I have a copy of it. And about 35 pages. And he goes over all the basic principles of Sanskrit grammar. PhDs in Sanskrit and ISKCON have looked at it and said, it's wonderful, you know. And so it gives you a very, very nice little perspective on the whole language. And when you read the purports and stuff, I'm sorry, the translations, you can start just naturally noticing the grammatical cases. It really helps a lot. But Radhika was giving a couple of the very, very first verse in the Bhagavatam is called something, the Playful Tiger. And the one in the Gopi Gita is called the something swan, you know. That would be also a very, very nice little thing to make up. Would be like an example for each of these verses and how to pronounce them and their names, like that. The Ministry of Education and Ramgiridhari and Goloka Education, if you go to Lofty Learning, a little plug here, like that, Lofty Learning, for $20 you can start taking an online conversational Sanskrit course. And I'm helping them develop this. And so far, I'm going to take it with some devotees from here. And it looks like they're doing their work. And of course, from Krishna culture, you can buy all the manuals and the books and the study guides. And it's designed to start off from first to third grade. But anybody can do it. Radhika's suggestion is that an adult who's very serious can do it three times as fast. But probably a regular ISKCON adult can do it twice as fast. Like that. And so it starts off with Mama Nama Hanuma Prishak Swami, Babatu Nama Kim, and what is your name? And just pass it around in a little circle a couple of times, and everybody's got it, you know? Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And then what's your name? And then after that is Suchalaya Gacha, what it is. And he's like, can I go to the bathroom? You get the ones for the class. And after that, they just become natural. You don't ask, can I go to the bathroom? Please sit down. Please raise your hand. You just start doing the Sanskrit. So conversational approach is a very natural approach. And even the government of India now wants to work on this, of bringing Sanskrit back as a conversational language. And then after that, of course, like you're saying, the verses being composed by Vyasadeva, I would say, yeah, because Sanatana Goswami used for 7 days or something, Rupa Goswami or Lord Chaitanya, and it's condensed into a much different thing. So yeah, this was not like, if somehow or other, we're not saying this is literally what happened. You know, maybe some of these questions were literal, but other ones, this was the kind of the question he said and stuff like that and so on. So our point is, what's it go? Mara's quoting this yesterday, and which basically means, I want to make you understand it as I have understood it. Yataritam yatamati. Very important point. Mara's made this point. Yataritam yatamati. So Suta Goswami tells the sages, I want to make you understand this as I understood it. And so it's the bhava we're trying to get across, the perspective, the attitude, you know, and so on. Once you've got the proper attitude, hey, you know, what you're going to think about it and everything else is going to follow properly. You understand the concept, but you haven't taken it to heart, still not as good. You know? So yeah, what they're trying to communicate in the Puranas is not the exact text, the Vedas, communicate the exact text. It's more the perspective. So maybe they did summarize it. They put it. For example, even read Bhakti Siddhanta's literature, the Brahma Samhita. Bhakti Siddhanta was using like a 128-bit parallel processor. We're stuck down here with 16-bit parallel processor. He could generate sentences like one paragraph long with sub modifiers and sub modifiers and cross reference modifiers. You know, prepositional phrases within prepositional phrases, modifying adverbs, right? and he could get the whole thing in his consciousness at one time. But we, as soon as we get beyond, you know, run spot, then we start to get a little problem there. As soon as we get like, you know, beyond 3 seconds, basically, the maximum span we have is 3 seconds in most Western people, maximum. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then maybe the same way, when Maharaj Pariksit was asking his questions, they were like, you know, basically like, you know, for us, like a paragraph-long question. And Sukadeva Goswami was coming back immediately with a paragraph-long answer, which covered every single aspect of it, you know. So Vyasadeva reduced this down to Dick and Jane for us.
Mm.
See, run, spot, run. And probably reducing it down probably to for the modern world, the level of modern intelligence, you know, yeah. So, yeah, we got something else. But the point is, do we get the bhava? And do we get the direct experience of it? Yeah, I know I got it. Why? Because I can ride the bicycle, bhava. Oh, okay, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it's amazing when you read about, like, Keshava Kashmiri speaking to Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. You immediately, or at least I immediately think, well, this is for the greatest scholar ever. But, you know, there was something like that. You know, when you speak Sanskrit, it's got to be in a certain meter and tone and rhyme. You know, for us, it's, you know, we struggle even to chant the verse.
Yeah. Radhika was giving this class on, on the Bhagavatam, Glories of the Bhagavatam in San Jose. It's very nice to watch. And this is the first part. And he was talking about translating it. And he says, maybe I mentioned this thing, when the Kumaras went to the gateway of Vaikuntha, which I guess they're going to do ahead here like that, and they weren't allowed to enter, he says that the translation is, you see duality in a place where there's no duality, and therefore you must be evil, you know, so on, you know. But he said every word they're using has actually the subtle context of house, home, like that, you know. And he said you have to almost write a whole commentary on it to bring it out. So just trying to translate, the text is so rich at multiple levels. You know, it's poetry. You know, when you do this in English, too, you can pick out certain words and stuff. And so somebody with different English ability can start to translate this and bring out subtle things and so on. And that's what Prabhupada's saying, these translations are not just ABC. He was bringing across subtleties and so on like that. The publisher said, this is so subtle that to find the English words to really give it a sense, they're saying that you're finding differences among family members, like that. You know, we're all origin of Vishnu, we're all his children, and you're finding differences amongst family members. But it's so subtle like that, again, like sati, being translated as unchaste rather than this, not true. And of course, for the Sanskrit speaker, it includes both meanings. And so on. You know?
Sure.
So we have a lot of opportunity. I guess when we die and take birth in Navadvipa, we'll all be in Navadvipa in our next lifetime there. Okay, I'm like, hey, weren't you Ramananda? Yeah, I was Narahari. Oh, I was Mother Irmala. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So now we'll go our Bhagavatam class with Lord Nityananda running around with no clothes on in the middle of the class. Like that. Prabhu, put your clothes on. I'm going to report you to the GBC. Okay, so thank you all very much.
Hare thank Krishna. You, Maharaj. Very nice class.
Very nice association, all of you. Hare Bol.
Jai,
Krishna.
See you next week.
Hare Bol. Hasta luego.